Hey, everybody. Yes. We are back for a new episode.
Hello, my geeklings.
Stranger episode because it's something we have never done before.
Never.
We were at VCon last week. And
that is the Vancouver convention.
And
of fantasy and science fiction.
Of fantasy and science fiction. And we recorded a live episode. So we just want to do a little quick introduction before we actually get into that.
Yeah. So it was up in Vancouver. Tanya Huff was one of the other guests of honor. We were guests of honor.
They brought us up
Miles
there to
Tevish.
Talk about
Miles Tevish. That's who I was.
And the creative team of Looking for Group, the webcomic.
They brought us up to talk about podcasting, about writing, directing,
acting.
Video game design, the whole deal. Yeah. It was pretty awesome.
It was really, really fun. And they just took incredibly good care of us and like that. However, the Marriott, which was hosting the event,
was less enthusiastic about our attendance. Or the attendance of VCon in general.
Exactly.
Really.
Well, the attendance of geeks
we don't know what,
in general.
We don't know what they felt afterwards. They may have been pleased as punch, but this was their. They were worried before we got there.
Yeah, I just love. Everybody was given this little, you know, handout right when you got to the hotel, and it said, "Welcome to the VCon 34 at the Vancouver Marriott Pinnacle. We want to say thank you for joining us at VCon this year, and hope that you have a pleasant, enjoyable stay." And blah 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 blah. To help make your convention better, we would like to let you know a few policies of this year's event. Smoking laws, that's fine. I get that. That's no problem. You know, absolutely. But then we get to this. Please note the third floor has been designated as, quote, costume safe. You may wear costumes in areas of the hotel on your way to your events, but please avoid congregating in public areas of the hotel, specifically in the lobby. You geeks, damn
right.
It. Costumes are prohibited in showcase restaurant and lounge, the pool, and the health club. Live-action role-playing games, lewd conduct, and any item that may be considered a weapon are not permitted on hotel property, and any attendee found participating in such acts or with such objects may be asked to leave the conference.
Right. I wonder what they would have done if somebody had tried to wear a chainmail bikini into the jacuzzi.
There was a woman who was wearing a chainmail bikini.
Yes.
However, she was wearing it over her velour jumpsuit, because it
was
Vancouver.
Strange.
Yeah.
It was a little chilly.
It was a little chilly. So
I'm trying to figure out what fantasy world that works in. You know?
Which is the reason why San Diego Comic-Con's better. It's warm enough to just wear.
I don't know. I loved Vancouver. I ate up Vancouver with a spoon.
I had to say Vancouver had just a better vibe than Comic-Con. Yeah, Comic-Con is great, but it can be a little draining.
Two different things. I mean, the one thing about, you know, before we get into this real quick, the one thing about that convention, it was really a convention about being a fan, not about the subjects they're fans of, really.
Necessarily. I mean, I thought it felt like Comic-Con in, like, 1989-1990.
I don't think what either of you are saying are mutually exclusive. It can
be
both.
Yeah,
but,
true.
Like, you know, they would have, like, a Joss Whedon panel with no one from Joss Whedon. They just talked about what it was like to be a fan of Joss Whedon.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? That's just so much cooler.
No, that's fine. You know? I'm just saying it's a different thing than
Comic-Con.
Fan con and not a...
Yeah, like I went to, Peter hosted a fantastic writers panel. It was really good.
Yeah.
And I went to it and he's asking the audience, like, how many people out there are writers? And like no hands went up.
Right.
Like there were no writers. They were just interested about hearing about the process of writing.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It was very interesting.
He's like, whoa, okay.
You go to Comic-Con and just like you have to beat the writers away from you with a stick if you're
they think they're going to get picked
Comic-Con
up.
Comic-Con is all about extremes. Yeah. I mean, everything at Comic-Con is at full volume, full max. Mm-hmm. You know, everyone's screaming. Everyone's trying to get here. Everyone's trying to get there. And sometimes that's great. I mean, you get like the girls in the chainmail bikinis without the jumpsuit.
Right? Yeah.
But at VCon, you know, it was so much more intimate and it was more like...
It was more geeky.
It was more like having a party with all of your...
Your buddies. Exactly.
What was the Tanya Huff quote? It's like being at VCon is like having a party with all the friends you haven't met yet.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah. She was awesome.
She was awesome. And we do a nice little interview with her on our little VCon coverage.
Which we'll do later.
So we're going to start this up here in a minute. But after the live show, we are going to cut back in with the interview.
Yeah.
And is that it?
That's it.
So, you know, it's a long episode.
Check it out.
We did have a little...
We had some technical difficulties, but we'll break back in when we get there.
Yeah, okay. Exactly. All right, should we crank this up?
Let's do it.
Grab the crank.
Welcome to Geeks On, a show created by geeks for geeks, covering topics that geeks like to talk about. This week, it's Geeks On, What Will We Do When the Aliens Arrive? For more information and news we talk about in the show, go to our website at www.geekson.com. All right, everybody.
Hello!
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome
on,
to
how often
Geeks
do you have to do this? This is the first time for me. Hello, Vancouver! Woo!
Welcome to another episode of Geeks On.
That's right. There is you might hear some clapping that you just heard. That is not fake clapping, which we
are
out in
our
shows all the time.
We're out of our multi-million dollar studio, and we've come to VCon.
That's right. We're up here in Vancouver at VCon, and we're doing a show in front of live people, which we've never done before.
They're live.
Very live people.
They are alive. We did one zombie audience, but that went over badly.
Yep. Exactly.
They only wanted one thing from us.
Brains.
But first of all, how about we do introductions? Matt.
Hello, my name is Matt King. I am an actor in Los Angeles and now here at VCon, and I am a geek.
Hi, my name is Aaron Hendricks, and I'm a graphic designer and filmmaker in Los Angeles. Now I'm in Vancouver, and I am a geek.
Hello, my name is Donald Marshall. I'm a video game designer and producer, and I, too, am now in Vancouver, and I am a geek.
Hello, my name is Pete Robinson, and I'm a screenwriter in Los Angeles, and I am a geek. And I'm here in Vancouver.
Woo! Oh, don't just linger by the door. Come on in. Oh, see, you made everybody look.
So, how was everybody's geek week/geek couple days?
Mine was awesome. Mine was really, really awesome. I got to come up to Vancouver to do VCon.
I know. And what have you seen here at VCon?
Well, first of all, Vancouver is an incredibly cool city. Mm-hmm. How many of y'all from Vancouver? Anyway, awesome.
So almost all locals.
Awesome. Almost all locals. It's such a beautiful, beautiful city of glass and... And I'm wondering how many exteriors they're actually going to be using for Caprica, because we saw them shooting out on the streets.
Yep.
I'm sort of geeking out because some of my favorite web cartoonists are here.
Really?
Terrell Hunt is here.
Terrell!
We have been hawking
right
his wares on
Terrell.
Our show for a little while now. The Goblins webcomic, all of our listeners know it very well.
Terrell! But, get your ass in here!
Oh, nope.
Yeah, he's right here. Come on. I see
Speaking
him.
Speaking of
right
Terrell,
walk up. Come on, Terrell.
He's doing a walk by.
Terrell Hunt.
We're just talking
to Terrell Hunt, ladies and gentlemen. That's what it is.
How crazy is this world?
It's like.
No. We're right. Come on right up to the mic, Terrell.
One of my high points for this geek week was actually getting to sit down across from a Dungeons and Dragons table with this man last night. Do you know how long it's been since I've actually got to sit down with a D20 in my hand at like 11:30 at night? I'm old. Like 11:30 is late for me now. And like we finished character generation at like 11:30. You know? It was a good thing.
We just want to say hi to you and have you say hi to our audience.
Yeah. We'll actually do an interview with Terrell later on.
Yeah.
And I think we're just going to add it onto the episode. But cool. Right now we just want to talk to you and say hey.
Awesome. Is this on?
That's on.
Awesome. Where's the audience? Is there?
Yeah. So you're here. You have a table here.
Yeah.
Outside.
Right outside there, which is where you guys paged me from.
Exactly. And but you were running some role playing games, which these guys were playing last night.
Yeah. I got to do a little Dungeons and Dragons with Terrell.
We geeked it out. It was awesome.
It was awesome.
Yeah.
And that's what this whole con, what's great about it, it's very intimate. You get to talk to everybody. The people who are selling books out on the floor or later running games, and then you're drinking with them. And this is definitely a different experience than I've had with, like, even at Comic-Con, there's a lot of distance between the people you're meeting.
Comic-Con is so monetized by this point that it's just like, it's much more who can sell you where. I feel like some of the passion is lost.
Sort of my observation about VCon so far has been is like the passion here is so much more sort of genuine about everything. I'm loving it. I'm loving it. It's a breath of fresh air.
At Comic-Con, you sort of feel like you're beholden to your corporate overlords. Like at any time, yeah.
All hail.
Damn, my corporate overlords.
Here you sort of feel like this is like a party with all of your best friends. It's kind of cool.
I'm curious. You know, you have a table here. How do you, what do you feel like you get out of a convention of this size?
Considering you're married. Well, I'm just saying.
The best thing about... a convention, especially a small one like this.
Come in on the mic, brother.
Hello.
There we go.
The best thing about a convention, like a small one like this, is you get to, when you're doing something like webcomics and you're working online, no matter how many people you have reading your material, you don't get to meet any of them or see their reactions unless you like read what they type in a forum or a chat room. So it's a great opportunity to have people come up to you and actually you can see their reactions. You can shake their hand. You can say hello and discuss things. Because like I did stand-up comedy for a while. And with stand-up comedy, the second you say a joke, if they love it, that you know right away the crowd is laughing. If they hate it, again, you know right away. With a webcomic, it can take like a week or longer to find out if something you created was...
That's a long time to find out you wrote a bad joke.
So
it's a lot of crickets.
It goes out there, oh, that one landed, good.
It could take a week on stage, too. Yeah, so coming to a convention, it's a great opportunity to meet people and actually... If something is funny, they'll talk about it. They'll laugh with you. And so it's the best thing about conventions.
Awesome.
Excellent. Woo. Well, thank you very much. We're going to catch up with you, I think, tomorrow. So we'll tag that interview onto this. So it might be seamless. You may not even know.
You may not even know when the time flew in and out because we're like Doctor Who that way.
Exactly.
We is. Awesome.
Thank you very much.
Terrell Hunt, ladies and gentlemen.
I'm going to be the time Nazi on here because we're going to do an episode in 1 hour, which we've also never done before on Geeks On. All so
right.
Are we going to do any news or anything here?
I think we should.
Okay, we're going to quickly do some Geeks On news.
Geek news.
So roll the sound.
Cue the music.
Love that music.
Oh, my God. Woo! Amazing.
Now, you see what happens behind the scenes. There's no damn music there. So whenever we joke about the music, we're actually not hearing anything.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. okay, Matt. What's this?
Story? All right. So, Don stole my entry page. Hang on. All right. Basically, this is written by Lawrence M. Krauss, who did the physics of Star Trek.
Uh huh.
It's a one-way ticket to Mars, and basically the long and the short of it. It's a very long article. I'll post it up on the site. But basically, Lawrence M. Krauss is posing the question of whether or not what we need to do to get to Mars is to get astronauts out there, and they'll die out there.
So build a plan.
Build a plan.
That
build a ship.
Entirely is based off of the fact that there's no return.
It's a one-way trip to Mars. That's it. You're going one way. You're going to stay up there. You're going to die on the planet. Because
sometimes
basically,
it takes some of the romance out of the whole prospect, doesn't it?
Well,
actually, it kind of adds some romance.
Well, yeah, exactly.
It,
that's what he's saying. Know? Is it kind of adds to
really?
The romance. He was actually referencing in certain way, not Ben Bova, who wrote Red Mars. I can actually ask the Geekling. Yes, Robinson. Kim Stanley Robinson wrote Red Mars. That was awesome. I can never do that at
it's
home.
Like
we'd just be sitting here going, and I'd be going, I got to edit that out. But it's amazing that they're planning, especially considering we have, I believe right now, 5,000 astronauts, and over the next 10 years, none of them will actually be going into space.
Well, I mean...
Yeah.
But think about it. What type of person, I mean, it takes a certain type of person to get strapped to a rocket and get shot into the air.
Yeah,
that's one type of person.
I'm going to light this rocket on my ass.
There's a guy here. Look, we've got a test pilot in our audience here. Would you go one way to Mars and never?
I believe his character
and
did.
How,
yes.
And really, and
are you
and how is Goose, by the way?
Keep in mind, there are no three-breasted mutant women waiting there for you either. You know,
Mars. A test pilot tests the craft. They
won
the return with the data. A lot. Yeah.
All right. There we go.
All right. So we have one no.
We have one no
and one yes.
We have one no and one yes. That's a 50-50.
All right. We'll test your sanity later. I don't know. I think that.
A transporter.
The transporter scares me so much.
Did you not see the fly?
Well, the concept, like, we're going to take your body apart and we're going to put a new body together somewhere else that may or may not actually be you.
Right.
Just thinks it's you.
Do you feel like they would send a man and a woman together?
Well, you might want to. I mean, basically what they're saying is that have you not seen Moon? He went nuts.
But yeah, but, well... Are we going to spoiler alert here?
No, but spoiler alert. But, if you want to establish a moon colony, they need to do more than 20 days of work before coming back. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things they're saying, is that they may need years of coming back. But once you've had that much gravity atrophy, being that far out, coming back to Earth will kill you no matter what. So why not continue the work?
I don't think it's going to happen. I don't think they're going to be able to convince a sane person to go one way alone.
I think that America is the land of... I mean, I don't think they'd have been able to convince people to go out to the Midwest and try and establish a family, and we'll give you a plot of land if you can defend it. And,
yeah, but you can go outside and breathe.
We have a comment here from an audience member.
All right, we should move.
Don't move the microphone because we hear that. It goes... Yeah.
Yeah. You can take a seat in the chair, though, if you like.
Lean down to it, though. Sorry.
Yeah, just crouch.
Just sit in the chair.
Sit in the chair.
You have 5,000 astronauts sitting idle. What are the chances, statistically, of one or two of them developing some sort of incurable condition over the next 10 years?
Oh.
Now that's a good idea.
So a terminal illness in an astronaut, a very noble one-way mission to Mars, that's okay.
Terminal illness.
See, we've got people thinking about this. It's in they're in our audience too.
Yeah,
that's a good idea.
Are you from New Zealand? No, Australia. What's he at? South Africa. You're an African American. Good to know. awesome, brother. Skin tone.
We are Canada right now, so
Canadian,
African Canadian.
Right.
All right.
So America centrist man.
Sorry,
I'm insulting our hosts.
We're United States
versus Canadians.
USAdians.
I think our topic should have been the difference between American geeks and Canadian geeks.
All right,
moving on. Go.
Time Nazi, I'm moving on.
Yes.
We need to go past news.
Yes. Run, Luke.
We're going to switch to our topic of the evening, and that is. Taking cue from some of the movies that have come out and some of the TV shows that are going to come out, what will we do when the aliens arrive to our planet?
How will we treat them? Our presupposed condition is that they will arrive.
Exactly.
They don't find us moronic.
Maybe.
I do have a question for you guys.
Okay.
How do you know they haven't already?
Okay, so I think that's one of the. We have a couple scenarios here. We just had District 9 come out. Transformers kind of plays into this scenario a little bit. I'd rather not talk about that movie.
Alien Nation.
It hurts.
Yeah, V, the television reboot is coming out very soon that covers this. We had an Alien Nation.
I just auditioned for that.
But I think we have three scenarios that have been, there's been plenty of scenarios, but three that are always come up.
Yes. Alien Nation.
It used to be when aliens came, we were attacking them. Back in the day, they were always attacking, so it was always, start shooting first.
They want our women.
Verata Nictu.
Exactly.
Mars needs women.
I think that changed for a while where we hid the aliens. There's all those stories where they've already, like Peter said,
they're already here. Men in Black.
The best course of action is to tell nobody, and we've got Area 51 and warehouse, blah blah blah.
Yeah, the government's dealing with it.
But now we've been coming out with these movies. Alien Nation was 15 years ago, but we have these integration stories.
Yeah. What does it tell you?
It's the integration allegory. Yeah,
our ego these days that the aliens are coming here as refugees.
What does it tell us about our ego that the aliens are no longer stopping over New York City?
That's kind of cool.
Oh, yeah. That was cool.
That was kind of awesome, in fact.
Well, so, taking...
Imagine living in New York City, just like, oh, look, another mothership.
Again. Well, taking those, I think that's a timeline. Do you feel like that timeline of what we've seen in the media reflect how we really would treat aliens?
Well, I think,
do you think we would start shooting first back in the day, or hide them, or now would we integrate them?
I think anything that shows up in a ship that floats is going to freak the hell out of us.
Okay.
And then as soon as it's floating over, this is awesome.
But what do you do after the freak out? What do you do after the freak out? Do you just fire, launch missiles right away?
No.
Or do you?
That's one of the reasons why D9 had me at Hello, is because they said, what was it? After 3 weeks of waiting, we went inside.
Yeah. Right.
And what that said to me was that for 3 weeks, the world was terrified. Then they went in and they found a bunch of aliens living in their own filth. Independence Day is the worst alien movie known to man. That is the worst example ever. Will Smith found a ship with an alien in it.
And he punched it out.
And then he got inside it, and the cockpit was made for a human being.
It was a bucket seat for an alien.
It had bucket seats. With something that had 16 arms.
Yeah.
What do you do when they arrive?
Yeah.
And they did start off trying to communicate.
Mm-hmm.
They were like, well, in case it attacks.
So one glimmering piece of corn in the piece of shit that was that movie.
But I agree with what you're saying. I think in our current state of mind, we would not attack first.
Mm-hmm.
We would not do that.
But would we not do that because we were afraid of retaliation? We or do you think it's because we're nice people?
What
these
I'm
days.
Saying is, while we attempt every form of communication, we are going to be getting together every type of weaponry we have available to us.
Yeah, there would be about.
I mean, I'd love to think. I think that Carl Sagan's
around. The world.
But that said, once we get past the fear point, we're talking about a peaceful meeting, a peaceful integration in this scenario. And I think one thing that every movie has sort of skipped at this point is the point of celebrity that would come first.
Yeah.
Like the
That's
first
actually what they're dealing with in
for
V.
the alien species, I actually think I know this is not exactly the topic, but on the TV show True Blood, right? There's the vampire
Segway.
Spokeswoman who becomes the big in the integration of vampires into society. There's this woman who's a spokesperson for the vampire race, who's a celebrity. Everyone knows who she is.
Well, that's also the way that they're dealing with V.
Yeah. Oh, true. V did have that. You're right.
Yeah, V and had it back in the day, and then they have
now
it.
They're really doing it now.
Yeah. So the
but think about it. Like, in every small town, in every city, someone would be able to sort of up their prestige for saying, like, well, I happen to know one of the aliens, and what she says is,
Yeah, exactly.
What Anna says.
The alien culture. Craze would come a little bit after that, like dressing in the styles of the aliens, sounding like them.
Well,
that brings up an interesting question. There's two different kinds of aliens. There's the aliens that look like us.
Right.
Come on, sit in the chair. All right, so to
we
break
just need
it down,
to make sure we
they're
get
the
you.
Aliens that look like
so
us.
I was saying, so there's these two kinds. There's the ones that look like us, right? So they're upright. They're upright. They have maybe extra limbs, but they're basically, they look like us.
You've seen one of these, obviously.
Yeah, no. Yeah.
We're close.
Star Trek, right?
We
and
chill.
Then there's the ones like in D9 where they don't, there are these monstrous things that maybe they can't speak our language because they just can't create it.
They speak through scent or something.
I would say, personally, I don't think an alien life form would look anything like us.
Yeah.
Not a chance, right? One of the best books I ever read is called Illegal Alien.
Yeah. Fantastic.
Fantastic book. They're like these tri-legged things, and they're completely different. And I think that would have a big impact on how we react.
Now, that's the court case one, right?
Yes, it is.
They're trying an alien for murder.
Yeah.
And it's whether or not we actually have like extradition rights over the alien.
Yeah.
I actually think the best way that it's been handled right now is in Arthur C. Clarke's Childhood's End.
Oh, that's a good one.
Which is basically where Arthur C. Clarke says that the aliens come down and they say, all right, you're not ready for us yet. We have superior technology to you. You can't see us without freaking out.
Yeah.
You can't get to us without cracking. So what we're going to do is we're going to keep distance from you. We're going to establish contact, but it's always going to be through an intermediary.
Maybe a correlation is the closer it looks to humans, the better we would treat them.
Yeah.
maybe.
Kind of.
The more connection points you can find. That makes perfect sense. Though, I do want to say that intelligence as an evolutionary trait tends to come out... I was talking about this with somebody this morning, strangely enough. Tends to come out of a lack of specialization in physical, in your body, right? So in that respect, it is possible... Like, there are only so many forms you can take that aren't specialized in a specific function. So, like, exoskeletons, that's a very special type of evolution to get to that size. It's unlikely that that sort of being would evolve intelligence because it just doesn't need it if it functions that well.
Yeah, I don't know. David Brin's Star Tide Rising and the rest of the Uplift saga are brilliant in terms of showing different alien species and how they evolve and actually how they communicate. There's this one set of aliens that I've constantly been trying to put into screenplays with Peter, and he constantly goes, "Oh, yeah, okay, Matt, stop," because they're a bunch of toroid aliens that just spout off gas at each other, and that's how they communicate. And Pete's like, "Yeah, real exciting, great, thanks, man. Yeah,
that's visual,
very visual. Very exciting. That'll be great."
Yeah,
you got to be by the mic. You can't just shout out.
You want to join in?
I don't sound anything.
This isn't a movie theater in Brooklyn.
This is going. The Disney movie Treasure Planet. They had a gas based.
You've gone from.
Oh yeah.
The flatuloid, and the guy talks, and he basically spouts various kinds of gas.
I don't know. I could be amused watching a big movie about humanoid cows passing gas.
Independence Day.
Keeping
to the
on subject, not about evolution of the aliens.
Keeping on subject is what we're known for.
Yes. Well, something that we said a second ago, which I thought was really interesting, because it's my own personal belief. If there was a race out there that was significantly advanced compared to us, my personal belief is they just wouldn't want to talk to us. I mean, they'd be looking at us kind of the same way we would be looking at a primitive tribe in the, you know, Amazon.
I don't think that's true. Let's put it the other direction. Let's say we go to Mars with the one man, one trip,
one way trip.
If he finds a creature on there that is primitive but can kind of eke out, you know, simple communication, you think we would just go, meh, just build a house over top of him?
No, that's not what I said.
We'd try to communicate with them, and we might...
My belief is they would be watching us, they would be studying us, but I don't think they would... I think we would be in kind of like a cordoned off area where we don't interfere. I think that they would be waiting until one of two things happened. Either one, we had the ability to travel and get into areas that they exist in, or two, until we had enough stability that them coming here and saying, hi, we're the aliens and we're here, wouldn't cause us to freak out, wars to start.
Well, that might be true, but to say that you have to be able to fly to my planet for me to talk to you is kind of...
Well, we can't fly to theirs. Elitist? We're useless.
The aliens are elitist?
We can't even get to the moon anymore. And we did that already.
We have an audience member here.
Yeah.
No, I was listening to you guys discuss how you believe that one of you believes that if they were intelligent, they would just leave us alone. that's a... I would almost call into question perhaps other possibilities. If we're talking about a space-faring race, an intelligent race, what drives people to go out and look around at their neighbors? It's curiosity, at least for us. That might not be their drive. Mm-hmm. But if they're going out for the love of knowledge, a certain amount of curiosity does drive that. And maybe this is taking too much of a human-centric view on it, but... look at the Victorians. Look at the early explorers, like, on Earth, when they were encountering, quote-unquote, primitive races. They didn't leave them alone. They poked them with sticks.
Yeah,
they
so you think it's the poke it with a stick mentality.
Hey, you and I are on the same
page. I agree with you completely.
Hey, they're dumb. Let's see what they give us. Oh, they gave us rocks. Let's see what happens when we give them guns. Oh, look, they're killing each other.
So does that mean
that
both of you guys are on the anal probe train?
Yeah,
No.
Yeah, that's what we call our theory.
The stand-apart mentality, the whole Starfleet... Prime Directive, that was a Gene Roddenberry invention.
Yes.
Like, that's not really a major concept up until that point. I believe that if a higher intelligence came here and found us, there are two possible motivations that they would have while observing us.
If they haven't actions, already.
Rather. One is exploitation, if they're capitalists, in which case they don't care what we think. We've got resources. And it's unarguable the Earth has massive resources. So the fact that we haven't been invaded and subjugated is an argument to say that we haven't made contact. Or two, if they're more altruistic, separation and observation doesn't achieve any goals. I would imagine that they would either be trying to make a subtle contact by making subtle changes in us, by maybe passing as us or leaving messages for some of us, and trying to guide us with smaller pieces of information towards a higher state of being.
Or just leaving information that they're putting an interstellar bypass through our planet and we didn't happen to check.
Or holding or holding small conventions around the planet to test out their theories to see if they could integrate. That's what I would do.
But this idea of capitalism, of them coming here for our resources, to me that's a little bit ridiculous, because if they can fly here, they can fly anywhere. And the idea that we've got some mineral or some element that they can't get
Earthonium.
On a million other planets. The only thing we've got...
real estate. We have prime real estate. We have real estate that can support carbon-based
real estate?
Life.
Well, now, if it's carbon-based life, are they really going to be...
But regardless of the type of life, that is of value. You know, as slave labor, as, you know, energy resource, you know...
Cow udders.
Yeah,
make
I'm
that cow
saying,
udders.
You know, the fact that it can be done that here and nowhere else makes it valuable.
That's Earthonium.
Cow udders are Earthonium.
My only question would be then is, if they are altruistic and they come here, well, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. That doesn't necessarily mean that they would actually pan out to be all that great for us, you know.
Very true.
Do you live in L.A.? You could be on our show.
Yeah.
You could be a regular.
Don't. Sorry. Aw, man.
Right.
Tease.
You've now scared her away, Aaron.
Oh, no.
She's running.
I was being truthful about that.
What were you saying?
I don't know. I was going to ask, Matt, what were you saying over the calendars? Is that what you're saying?
No, cow udders are actually Earthonium. Yeah.
That's the...
that's the mineral that they're all coming to find.
Right.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, it always comes back to that for me. You know, how to serve man. It's like, no matter how altruistic they might seem, I think it's in human nature to distrust pure altruism. You always wonder what it's doing for you.
Yeah. Well, right. I mean, that's also coming from the mankind view of an egotistical society because, you know, we don't know whether or not the race that we run into, be it like Ender's Game, is a hive mind. Is it something that because it's a hive mind, it doesn't understand the individual and therefore they don't communicate with us in the same way, so they decide to run us over? I mean, where are we going to hit the communication conflicts?
I'd like to bring up something that might be controversial.
Okay.
What do you think the religious sector would think about aliens arriving?
Don't you think it's just going to F it up?
Oh, yeah.
But, I mean, there's always every time religion hits an impasse, it slowly gets worn down till it's just a speed bump.
Yeah, but
you
know, it usually
like, remember you told that
goes
story?
Down kicking and screaming in the process.
Yeah, I mean, you told that story about the guy in your school who his pastor told him that it was the second coming, right?
Yeah, and yeah, they did.
Yeah, it was like
they were going to show up on
Thursday. Thursday.
Yeah.
Sorry, Aaron. You know, if you're not there, Jesus is coming like a thief in the night, and he's taking you.
Right.
And I'm really upset because we're not going to be able to play D&D in heaven.
So. They don't allow the monster manual up there. It's evil.
Yeah, well, exactly. Just first edition 3.0. That's it.
it would also depend on which religion,
right?
Because there are many religions in the world. I know that a lot of the pagan community would probably embrace it.
Buddhism, of course, would.
Well, the pagan community is really much a religion about change and embracing change, but not many religions can make that claim.
This is true. You know? But I think as far as Christianity is concerned, you'd still have the very conservatives would balk at it, but there are a lot of Christians that I know that would also welcome it as well.
Oh, absolutely. But yeah. I see a
splintering. And then it would evolve into the neo-alien, you know, Jesus was actually an alien, came down from...
Yeah, no, I'm thinking more about the religions as an organization, not necessarily the individual, because, you know, I know all sorts of religious people who would, you know, totally embrace it. But I think, you know, part of this, the religions around the world is partly about power. Some of it's business.
True.
And you're taking away a multi-billion dollar business away from some people. And I'm wondering, you know, how much influence they would have on making decisions about what to do with, visitors. But another thing is, you know... to bring up another...
You're in trouble now, man. You're in trouble now.
She's back. No. All right, you have to introduce yourself. Right. You've been on the show four times.
Make a comment because I have one after that.
My name's Jenny Merrifield.
Hi, Jenny Merrifield.
Yeah, I'm the VCon Games coordinator.
Awesome.
I was just going to say that Actually, now you made me forget my point.
Hold your 20-sided die close to you and think of it.
So you were, yeah.
You can do it, Jenny.
What did you just say?
Big business, billion-dollar business, religions taken away. Will they decide?
I wish you could all see what we see. This is a beautiful thing right now.
Menstrual.
This is the magic of what we do, though.
It's actually giving birth out of her forehead.
Yes. It's
constipation.
It's a thought.
It's a notion.
She's going to get
she's consonantated.
Have no concept how often we do this.
She might pass a vowel.
We edit this out when it's us, we edit this out. When it's you, not so much.
Is that a vowel movement?
And a future happens.
She's going to have a vowel movement.
At any second.
Okay. Now, okay.
It's gone. It's gone.
We have chased her away.
She's going to go take some verbal Malox. She'll be back later.
Here's something else that I've said.
3 o'clock in the morning, she's going to be like, Aardvark! That was it!
Damn it!
Well, we'll still be up, so you can come and visit. We'll edit it in.
Just track us down. We'll put it in.
This is something I've said to other people in the past when we have talked about race relations. Usually I'm talking with my less geeky friends when I bring this subject up, and then they look at me strange. But one of the things I've said in the past is that I think that the races on our planet will probably come together.
Yeah.
The instant they have somebody else to hate.
But with that,
well, at least you got two arms and two legs.
But we can
see
that actually happen. In the United States, I don't know if it was like this in Canada, but after 9/11, all of a sudden black people had it a lot easier for a little while. Like all of a sudden it was Middle Easterners that were getting the racial profiling and harassed at airports and stuff, and black people got to go through security checkpoints looking at them going,
at least you're American.
Deal with it.
Yeah.
And so I've always said that, you know, that could be the thing that brings us as a world together for the first time, which would be kind of cool.
So do you actually
agree
with the Watchmen mentality in a certain way?
What's the Watchmen mentality?
That you need to have something to hate in order to be, you know, universally accepted or to find love.
Oh, there are political
parties. That's what the ending of that was all about.
Yes, that's the allegory. Not blue penis.
But honestly, which did you walk away from the movie with?
I don't know about that. I would hope, you know, I don't want to be pessimistic about that point, but I don't know.
Yeah.
I think it's for some reason human nature to separate ourselves from other things, and I'm not sure why, and that may be allow us to, you know, have that separation from something, which then will allow us to accept other people. I'm not sure why we're built that way. This guy might know.
Oh, he's got a question, and he's got a geek swagger on. So
now you saw what happened to the last person. So
beware.
Right. Don't mind me. I'm just a clockwork goblin.
Oh yeah, that's right. You played the clockwork goblin last night. Fantastic, man. Great plan.
Never seen that die roll that well in 20 years. Something that factors into how we react to change, challenge, whatever, is it temporary or is it permanent? As your Mars mission example there, if it's a one-way trip, we have to put up with them forever. If they're just here next week, who cares? It affects how we think about the problem.
That's a really valid point. It's the celebrity effect. If it is a temporary thing, we tend to put it on a pedestal because they don't have time to get off it.
Right.
You know.
Well, you know, I don't know. I think there's some things that would stick with us. I mean, even if we intellectualize that we are not the only thing in the universe, we still, I think, deep down inside, have this weird comfort that we're somehow special. I think we just do built in. And I think there would be a dramatic shift in the way we think about ourselves. Even if someone just showed up for a day and said, oh, guess what? You guys aren't as special. There's hundreds
You're not of an only child.
Yeah. And then
you
and then,
have to share.
And then leave. And I think that would make more change than I think the
world is ready for.
One of the biggest upsets in the past few hundred years was when Galileo came up with a concept that the Earth revolved around the sun, and that we weren't the center of the universe.
And people didn't like that.
What if we come up with, like, basically the biological and spiritual equivalent of we are not the center of the universe? There are other souls. There are other bodies. We are not the be-all and end-all. We are not the alpha and omega.
And not only are we not the center of the universe, we are the flea on the ass of
the universe. Dare you?
Law, sir.
JC, you have to introduce yourself. You've been up here three times.
Yeah, I'm JC from Seattle.
What way to go.
I have a question. You said the topic was aliens that have landed, but what about like shows from the abyss or TV shows like Surface? What about aliens that might have...
All right. Let's do it again.
Okay, well, the question was, what about aliens that may have been here first, like from the abyss or Surface?
Awesome. So, yeah,
Matt.
Well, that's a perfect segue, Aaron.
I didn't hear that
coming.
If you
think about religion, I know. If you think about religion, they're sort of the all-father, the all-mother. If you think about Arthur C. Clarke's 2001, 2010, the alien is effectively there creating us. Mm-hmm. They're raising us from nothing. To spoiler alert, who's read Childhood's End? All right, a lot of it. Okay, the rest of you just put your hands over your ears and hum. The end of Childhood's End, one of the things is when we finally meet the aliens, they look like devils. They have... Okay, so we had a little bit of technical difficulties.
Pausing for difficult technicalities.
Mm-hmm.
Moving our multi-million-dollar studio
it's
up
difficult.
To Vancouver.
It's hard to get it through customs.
16, 18-wheelers, the helicopter.
Yeah. And they don't really have good roadies in Canada.
There was a gremlin in the system. Okay, that's all I'm saying. There's a little gremlin.
It was after midnight, and we bit it.
Yes.
All right, so Matt, what were you saying?
So basically what I was saying is in Childhood's End, these devils that they have mm-hmm. have always been here. They've been like angels and devils, and that's how they moved our technology forward. That's how they moved human beings forward, and now they're just moving us off the planet, is that we've reached a level of maturity. And in the Abyss, I felt like those aliens, if they were in fact aliens, because there's never really necessarily... The ship doesn't take off and go into space. Mm-hmm. The ship just rises. So I felt like these aliens had been in coexistence with us and perhaps educating us
for
years.
Well, that's another one of those movies that if you see the original cut before it was cut down for the theatrical release, you find out that they essentially... give us a second chance because we're on the brink of a nuclear war.
Right.
And they
and they go, okay, you know what? Well, we're going to kill you all.
Yeah, we're going to wipe you out unless you guys, cool it.
Right.
And we've seen that story with 2001.
Right.
Or 2010, really.
Kind of both. And
2001, the aliens help us evolve and move forward throughout, our history.
So many stars.
And there's all sorts of, stories about how we've integrated previous alien contact into our culture. There's all sorts of
Mayan.
Like even Stargate kind of has that idea. Oh, and Battlestar Galactica, where the original Battlestar Galactica had this whole like Egyptian Mayan,
mm-hmm. Even in the helmets.
In the helmets, you assume that we all came from the same place, or that they helped us out, or whatever.
Right.
So but maybe that's the thing. If the aliens had come in the past, they would have helped us out and we would have accepted them. But now if they show up, we're going to...
Yeah, now they're always going to blow us up.
Now we're going always going to blow... Yeah, exactly.
We know it. We know enough.
We were okay with them back
Well, listen,
in the day.
They were helping us when we were children. Now we're in our teenage years and we can do it ourselves.
We're just dicks.
Maybe you're right. We are in our teenage
years. We are in our teenage
years.
That's
interesting.
That's actually a really good point, Pete.
It's actually a really great way of thinking about it in a lot of ways, because teenage years are some of the most dangerous years.
It's also when you test your boundaries.
Yeah.
So.
Well, it's also the years that you can really mess yourself up and,
And we reject everything that our parents stood for or offered to
exactly.
us.
Exactly. It's the Mark Twain quote. I left home when I was 18 years old because my father was an idiot. I returned when I was 26, and I was surprised how much the old man had learned in the 8 years.
Right. Exactly.
I love that. All right.
So we made our transition to the Geek Haiku, and it's unfortunate that we don't have it.
We don't have it all there.
Yeah, we have bits and pieces of it, and because it was awesome. People were rolling.
Yeah.
I mean, they really...
Surprisingly.
Yeah, it was pretty great.
Surprisingly, we're actually laughing.
Should we do our interview first, or do you want to do the? We just do tack the interview on the end.
Yeah, let's tack the interview on the end.
We'll, you want to do some geek haiku?
Let's do some geek haiku.
Just rework it. My geek haiku was focused on the topic alien. Yep.
Remind people what
yes, a geek haiku is of course five syllables, seven syllables, five syllables, and the theme for this geek haiku was aliens. Although aliens. Peter decided it was VCon.
I got confused, right. Which happens a lot. So really, you're used to it by this point. I mean,
you're lucky you're pretty. That's all I'm saying.
All right, so my first one is called On Course. See if you can identify which show I'm referring to. They came in great force. Advanced Race presents a book. Oh, to serve mankind. For you
deep
Twilight Zone fans out there.
They flew by my car. The mashed potato maces. Yes, this means something.
Okay.
Little ode to some Dreyfus.
All right, here's my my VCon geek haiku. VCon, we love you. Geekiness rides the same paths. Adventure begins.
Oh, and everybody rushed in and gave
your
me a
warm fuzzy.
Yeah. I have a serious one as well. This one, well, I don't know if this needs a title. Religious leaders, ask yourself if God made them in His own image.
Ooh.
Makes you think, doesn't it?
All right. Yet another movie ode. They came from on high. Aztec chariots of fire. Crystal skull still sucks.
I agree.
Yeah, that's pretty much spot on.
There we go.
Let's see. So I got dice, clatter, and roll. Words paint pictures on my mind. Fantasy takes flight.
And also an ode to fantasy flight, which is good. Donnie, you got yours.
Yep. I have one. Unfortunately, the other one I wrote for VCon is lost to the sands of time. It is the lost haiku.
It is the lost haiku.
If anyone can recover it, it'll be worth millions of dollars.
To someone.
Somewhere, I'm sure.
Not us.
But it's a Geeks On original. Come on. So this one is called E.T. is a member of NAMBLA. His neck grows erect. Glowing finger touches boy. Something is wrong here.
Oh. That was really rude sounding, by the way, how you read it.
I actually remember the laughter in that one was pretty awesome.
That was pretty awesome.
They just liked the word erect.
Matt, why don't you go back and put fake laughter under all this?
Okay, I'll put fake laughter under everything.
Okay.
But actually, you have some. So we can put some of the real laughter.
You can just I'll splice in the real laughter.
I'll record
still think
people.
That means it's fake. Okay. This is another TV reference. It's called TV.
Okay.
Guinea pig hors d'oeuvre. Gross alien baby birth. Don't need a remake.
Yay!
ABC. I'm talking to you, ABC.
All right. Finally. A light in the sky. Long fingers touching my skin. Please don't probe me there.
That's my favorite one.
It's a sentence I never thought I'd hear out of Matt. I'm just saying.
What? The don't part?
Please don't throw it.
Peter,
all
you
right.
Done?
I'm done.
Ann's done.
That's it.
Aaron's done. That is haiku.
I like geek haiku.
I'll try and make that work so that it fits in with the rest of what we got
there.
I'll
give you the geek haiku music, too.
Okay. No, I have it.
Why don't we wander over into our interview
with
Tanya Huff?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yes, exactly. She was very kind to take some time through running around. She actually goes to that convention.
She's
and,
awesome.
Yeah, and she's like they knew her, and I don't know.
Yeah, half the people at the convention seem to know her personally. So Tanya Huff is a very popular Canadian writer.
And now you guys are pen pals.
We are. She's very.
You guys were like buddies. At the end of it,
We went through hell together.
Yeah,
but she is a well-known writer of fantasy, of gothic, modern fantasy stuff, as well as fantasy. But she's probably best known for is the Blood Ties series, which actually was turned into a television series that made it over for one season in the U.S. On the Lifetime Network. So let's talk to Tanya Huff.
Let's do it.
Casino.
Okay, so we are here with Tanya now, and can you just tell us a little bit about how you got started in writing?
How I got started in writing?
Yeah.
Well, I was always a big reader. I was a huge reader as a kid, but I had no idea where books came from. I have a very working class family, and we're not a family that had books in the house. So thank God for school libraries. And then in grade 9, I met a girl named Karen Leahy, so Karen is completely responsible for my writing career, who was writing these horrible pastiches of Zena Henderson pastiches. And it was like a little switch went on in my brain. It's like, oh, wait a minute, people write books. I was like, damn, I have no idea where they came from before that. Like, maybe they sprung.
So she was a bad writer?
No. Well, no, she was 15, for God's sake.
You,
writer
you said horrible pastiche.
Just pointed a little.
Too much? Too off the mouth? Okay.
A little bit. Yeah.
Sorry.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you said horrible pastiche. I was just wondering whether or not.
You know, at 15, she's 15, who does anything well at 15? And actually, it was grade 9, so she wasn't even.
I don't know. The Black Orchid poem that I made for my girlfriend when she dumped me was.
Hey.
That was
work
deep.
Of art.
That was.
ten years old, I sold 2 poems to the Picton Gazette.
Wow.
Hey.
My first professional sale
about?
When I was
Cheers.
10.
Cheers. My God.
Yep. Took me almost 30 years to do it again. But no, I guess until I was almost 30. I was 29 when I sold my first book. So.
Awesome. What was your first book?
My first book was Child of the Grove, which was a sort of traditional romantic fantasy.
And what? How long was it in development before you finally got it out the door and to do what it needed to do?
About 2 years. Not that long. For,
oh, really?
For first books, not that long.
That's not that long at all.
It was I originally wrote it as a YA, and I sent it off to YA publishers and kept getting these wonderful rejections back. They said, this isn't really a YA book. And so I rewrote it as an adult novel and sent it to Daw, and Daw's bought everything I've sent them ever since.
Oh, wow.
I have a very embarrassing career because, I mean, I have no hardship stories. Mm-hmm. Marion Zimmer Bradley got my name wrong on a rejection once. Does that help?
It doesn't count as a rejection if
well,
they
we have a lot
name.
Of listeners that are aspiring writers, of course. You know, but so at 29, right? What made you decide at 29, you know, now is the time for me to actually get off my duff and write this book that's in my head? What was the catalyst for
you? I was always writing. It's just at 29, I got a book that was actually worth sending to somebody.
So you always had it in you.
I always had it in me. That wasn't a problem. There's I have drawers full. Actually, what I actually have are, you know, those old milk crates that we used to put albums in back when, God, I'm dating myself here. Albums, those big vinyl discs that you could now pay for vast amounts of money for certain bands. I have boxes of old stuff that I wrote through high school. Once I discovered people wrote, you couldn't stop me. I was one of those kids. I was writing on a clipboard in my history class once, and my teacher stupidly said, "Would you like to share what you're doing with the class?" And I did.
Well, you
How'd
know that
over?
Three classes later,
pretty well. But I'm betting he talked to every other teacher in the school because no one ever asked me to do that again.
You know, how many books did you write before you finally found one that you thought this is good?
Well, I never thought they were bad. I just didn't think they were publishable.
Right.
Let me see. Probably about 7. And they were short. We're talking like I doubt any of them. You know, top 60,000 words. They were short books. But right. Yeah,
well, that's one thing. You know, we're all artists in different ways, and I think a lot of people don't realize that it's also a craft. And you know, you have to work on your craft. You don't just magically. Well, I guess some people do magically pop out. Works of art that are, you know, perfect, but you have to build your bag of tricks. You have to work out the kinks. You have to get the your first thoughts that everyone else has already out the door. So the second and third thought process, you know, can be written about. And this is just another example of what you're saying is that, yeah, you know, it takes some time to get through that. The cobwebs, in a way.
You need to learn the skill set.
Yeah. Right.
It's like any other job. I mean, you no one just suddenly decides, I'm going to be a doctor. You know, I think it'd be really cool to cut people open. I know where body parts are. I have a body.
Right.
But people constantly think that about writing. It's like, you know, right. I write letters to my mom. I'm sending 15 emails a day. You know what? Mm-hmm. I think I'll write a book.
right,
without ever having developed the skill set it takes to do it. I mean, there's.
Were you in other forms of writing? Were you in journalism, or did you study it at all? Or
my training is radio and television arts. I went to the radio and television arts program at Ryerson Polytechnic. Mm-hmm. It's a university now, but it was a polytechnic then, and polytechnic is so much cooler to say. So all my formal training is actually in media writing.
Hmm. And what were you doing to survive while you were? I mean, and how were you writing?
I worked retail.
So you were writing while you were doing retail?
I was working. Oh yeah, I was working. I was managing a flea market on Yonge Street in Toronto. I was one of those early, you know, buy a big empty building and put 50 stalls in it and charge them all. I was worked for the guy who ran the big building, and so I was managing this big building. And my ex at the time said he was just got tired of listening to me bitch about not having time to write. So he said, if I find you a part-time job,
would you please write?
Would you please stop complaining at me? So he found me a part-time job and left me, but that's another story entirely. probably not connected
not
to the
bitter.
Job.
Did that end up in any writing?
In the first story I sold my first story to Andre Norton's Magic and Ithcar. It came out in Magic and Ithcar 3, and I dumped him into a vat of quicklime.
Nice.
Wow.
Therapy. It's cheaper.
That's
than
vindictive.
Therapy.
Oh, God, yes.
Peter, what's the George R. R. Martin quote about architects? And
we talked to George R. R. Martin at one point, and he said there are two types of writers. He said there are architects and planners. He said architects are people who, before they even put their first word on the page, they know the walls are going to go here, they know the electricity is going to go here, the plumbing is going to go here, and they know everything before they start. And they said then there are planters, and planters take a seed and they dig a hole and they bury it in the ground and they water it with their blood and they just hope and pray it's going to go in a good direction and grow into something worth, you know. And
would you say you are either of those?
I'm a wall builder.
Okay.
I write like I'm building a brick wall, and every course has to be absolutely perfect before I can go on to the next or your wall falls down.
Hmm.
But do you know what the roof looks like before you start building? In other words, do you see the full vision and know where you're heading when you start, or do you see where you end up as you write?
Or are you just Chinese and just building walls?
I like walls. Walls are cool. Keep the Americans out. Sorry. If I live on a lake, we'd have to mine it.
How dare you?
Got to watch these guys all the time sneaking across the border.
Exactly.
Taking our jobs. I have no idea where I was going when I started that.
The wall building.
That's right. Okay. I always have an ending in sight. Before I start writing, I always know where I'm going.
Mm-hmm.
I always have an end. I almost never know how I'm going to get there.
Right.
But I know my starting point. I know my finishing point.
Okay. Interesting.
And do you have a sense of how you want your character to change over the course of the piece, or do you just see what happens?
I just tell a story. I sit down and I tell a story, like I was telling a story to you guys. It's the same thing I do when I'm writing. I start at the beginning and I tell the story to the end. And so changes that happen are usually a big surprise to me too. Now, I'm suspecting that, you know, subconsciously I'm doing all this work, but consciously I just tell a story. It's like sitting around a campfire with me and I'm telling you the story.
Can you explain a little bit about the different genres that you've explored, and then what you have and why you've settled on particular ones? Like, have you explored different genres, or did you know exactly?
I just tell a story. I tell the story. The genre just is the tag to the story I have to tell.
Okay.
Like, honestly, I don't sit down and decide to do a genre to say, okay, this book I'm going to do urban fantasy or I'm going to do space marines. I just think, oh, cool, I have this really cool story for, suppose we do Zulu with space marines and giant lizards, which is what Valor's Choice is.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so that's where I come from. I don't actually make conscious decisions about. And having said that, I do occasionally make marketing decisions in which I will sort of say, well, you know, right at the moment, I've picked up a lot of fans from Blood Ties, the TV show. I should probably capitalize on that, do another urban fantasy now to keep them reading my books and then let them spread out. So I will make decisions like that. But it's all devolved from story.
Okay. So let's touch on Blood Ties a little bit.
Okay.
Aaron, you had something you wanted to say?
No, it wasn't related to that. But okay.
Nice segue.
You're one of the lucky authors right now that's had one of your titles cross over into television. Like, was that amazing for you? Was that scary,
heartbreaking.
What do you think about it?
It was fun. It was an incredible experience. I loved doing it. The Blood Books have been optioned since the middle of the 90s. I mean, for a while, Tony Danza's production company had optioned them because Tony wanted to play Salusi. So
really?
Interestingly enough, that was almost everybody's reaction.
I don't see it. I don't know why.
So the Kaleidoscope Productions, which is a small Canadian company out of Toronto, picked up the option, and these guys were amazing. They worked their butts off to bring this to television, because trying to get financing, well, trying to get financing even in the States these days is not easy.
No.
But trying to get it in Canada is not easy by a magnitude of, exponential magnitude of thing.
By really hardness. Yeah.
Yes, very, very hard. So... So these guys were great. They and so because they worked their butts off to get it onto the screen, and because they couldn't give me the kind of money that would be happening if it was coming out of L.A., they kept me involved in the process. They let me watch audition tapes, and it was just it was so much fun. And Christina Cox, who played Vicky, was always one of the actresses I saw as playing Vicky.
Oh,
so
cool.
When she got cast, I made an extremely embarrassing noise in a very expensive restaurant. They were showing me her tape. So and when they cast Dylan Neal, I had to admit in public that I watched Dawson's Creek. That was kind of embarrassing.
That sounds that process actually sounds very rare. You are lucky that
again, you're lucky.
We hear so many heartbreaking stories about you know, these writers handing it off, and then they never really gets away from them. They never see anything, or it actually never gets produced because of a pilot that goes.
Yeah, Zora Neale Hurston
hand it off entirely, or.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, so you did no writing on it at all?
Well, I wrote one of the episodes. I was essentially brought in as a freelance writer to do the episode, which was, you know, 30 years later, I finally got to use my degree. Yay.
Right.
So I was brought in that respect as a writer, and I was credited as a creative consultant, which meant, you know, the guys could call me up and say, and this is pretty much the one question that they asked me, was, so how old was Vicky when her father left again?
Oh.
Because, you know, it's all there in the books, and they all had the books, and we had a great group of writers, and they were doing an amazing job. And Peter Moen, who was our showrunner, was willing to take the job because he loved the books so much. I mean, these guys were all coming from a not we can make money at this, but we love these books, and they make great television. So, I mean, I don't buy lottery tickets anymore because I figure I've already cleaned up as much as I'm going to. I don't know every bit of luck I have.
I believe it was Zora Neale Hurston who said... plays and novels are the children that you keep, and screenplays are the children that you give away and hope they come back to you some way, someday looking like you. Did you feel like you were giving away a child of yours and with hopes, you know, a sort of wincing hope that it wouldn't hurt? Or were you like, hey, great.
You know, this, it's funny because I was live blogging with Lifetime because it showed in the States in Lifetime, and I was live blogging about it, and people were all busy going, oh my God, they changed the books. It's like, they didn't change the books. The books are exactly the way they were before they started with them. If you want to read what I wrote, read the books. So I always saw the television show not so much as a child, but as a grandchild.
Interesting.
Interesting. Okay. That's a really healthy perspective to have in this sort of situation.
And if you want to be friends with your grandchild, if you want to have a part in your grandchild's life, you don't talk about the way their parents are raising it. So I just enjoyed the experience. I had a wonderful time with my grandchild. I got to, you know, hug preternaturally pretty people, which is always nice.
Right. So when your grandchild came to visit and you got to write that one episode.
Yeah.
What was that like?
That was so cool. So cool.
Now, did for your episode, did you revisit like something that you loved from the book, or did you just take the chance to do something new with their version of your work?
Oh, I wish I'd had that much control.
Oh, okay.
No, it was we went, they were still in Toronto at the time when they were assigning freelance stuff, and so I went in and we broke the story in the room, and essentially our showrunner had said, okay, this is what's on the board. You know, these are the points on the board. You're interested in any of them. And I said, well, the Medusa story seems kind of cool. So we broke down a Medusa story. So that's how we did it. But I pulled from points on the board because it was their show.
And they had an arc that you still had to fit into.
Right.
The great thing was is that I didn't have to go in and pitch because I was already in.
That's awesome.
So, yeah. I totally skipped a step. It was great.
Sounds like you've skipped a lot of steps.
I skipped the really hard stuff.
Yeah.
Now, you were talking a while ago about developing a craft.
Mm-hmm.
And for people who are, you know, say, in the process of developing their craft, do you have any sense of what some of the things you learned? Do you have a sense of what some of the things that you learned were along the way? Or were they just very internal things and you just knew your craft was getting better?
Well, sometimes I would think it's probably internalized because it's mostly a way of just, you just keep doing it. You just keep doing it. one of the things Andy Offit said, which I thought was very brilliant. Andy Offit was a science fiction writer. I'm not sure he's been writing anything lately, in all honesty. I'm not even sure he's still alive. God, that's embarrassing. But he has said once, he said, you write subjectively, but you edit objectively. Hmm. And that's what you have to learn. The writing is art, but the editing is craft. And you cannot be, you cannot make a living as a writer if you don't learn to edit yourself subjectively. If you don't suddenly say, my God, that paragraph is brilliant, but it does not belong in that paragraph, lose it.
That's the killing the babies that that sometimes happen with all artists.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. At some point you have to say, you know, this is great and I love it, but it doesn't belong here. Mm-hmm. And the people who will not succeed as writers are the people who never learn that.
Right.
What was your process to get to that point? In other words, there's a point of being less precious about, we just talked about this, being less precious about your work and getting to that moment which you can do that. And maybe that's the objective part of that process, is being able to let some of that stuff go.
I think it helped that I started writing, like I pretty much wrote every day through my teens. I mean, we were just writing a ton of fiction besides schoolwork, but because that's part of what it is practicing every day. So I think during the most precious years of my life, you know, during that time when you think every thought you have is complete brilliant, you know, when you read The Fountainhead and are completely unbearable for the next 6 months, that was when I was doing all the precious stuff. So I got it all out of the way during the time when I believed every word out of my mouth was the word of God.
Right.
So that by the time I got older, I had the skill set. I had now the mental maturity to edit myself, and I had the skill set to edit.
Excellent.
I'll save it.
And I had never had a computer crash. And halfway through Long Hot Summoning, the heads came off on my hard drive and bounced across the disk. So not only did I not have backup, but they couldn't pull it off the disk. I had to rewrite the whole book from scratch. I back up obsessively now.
Yeah. Oh, once it bites you in the ass
crazy.
Once.
Don't mind that I recorded that, dude.
No, I don't mind.
Once it bites you in the ass once, you will learn your lesson for the rest of your life.
Well, the smart people will. I'm quite sure there are people out there going, it's happened once, it'll never happen again.
What are the chances?
How far into the novel were you when that happened?
Almost to the 2/3 point, and it
how
just
many, wow. How many words was that?
Oh, books about 66,000 words, between 60,000-65,000 words. And what
well, you got
really,
to rework it.
Yeah, but what really kills me is these are the comedy books. These are the books that are like the comedy urban fantasy, and it's never as funny the second time. It is. Yeah. There is stuff in there that I just killing myself for having lost, because you know you write it and it's still good, but you're thinking, man, it was so much funnier the first
time.
Yeah,
like it's like you're retelling someone else's joke.
Exactly.
It's crazy. Yeah, I don't understand that.
Huh.
Can we move maybe toward, we're here at a convention, VCon. I'm interested in the response that you've had with fans and how you interact with them.
Some background. I got to throw some background at you. Okay. I've stopped in at the hospitality suite on more than one occasion, and there's constantly these whispers of, Tanya Huff, did you see Tanya Huff? Oh my God, I saw Tanya Huff. She was awesome. Oh my God, Tanya Huff is here. What? She's here. Where is she?
Give me a hot dog.
There's
actually,
a
she's
buzz.
Standing over there eating a banana.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. You know?
She's right behind you.
The buzz around here about your attendance has been fantastic. Have you felt that?
Well, the thing is, I'm probably not feeling the buzz, just because for me, I went to my first science fiction convention in 1976. Mm-hmm. I was stationed at Mill Cove when I was in the reserves, and it was in this little tiny science fiction convention at Greenwood, Nova Scotia, across the province, and they were showing the Star Trek blooper reel, and I convinced two guys who were serving with me, because when you're 20 and blonde, you can do that, to drive across the province to see the Star Trek blooper reel. It was my very first convention, and it was like coming home. It was like, oh my God, these are people who get the joke. They're reading the same things I'm reading. Yeah, my people. So for a long time, my social life was with science fiction fans, and you know, you get together at conventions, and these are my peeps. But once you become a professional, science fiction conventions become 72-hour infomercials.
Right, sure.
Because you're selling yourself all weekend.
Right.
I mean, you can't relax. You can't bitch out. You can't stand in a corner and say what you really think about certain very popular books. Mm-hmm. And they're making way more money than you are, and man, that sucks. But
not that we're talking about any particular book.
Not that I'm specifically mentioning any particular book.
Okay, not at all.
And they make movies out of them.
And they make movies out of them, and they sparkle in the dark. Oops, that kind of gives it away. Anyway. So for me, being at a convention, I'm just there with, it's just so cool being with people who get me. mm-hmm. that I don't, it's weird, I don't really get the professional feedback. Mm-hmm. I got actually called the anti-snob at a convention once. Because, you know, some writers are really hard to get close to, but you're like the anti-snob. I'm like, okay.
Is that good or what is that?
You've been really available to people at this convention. I've noticed that. You know, you haven't gone off and hidden your room.
I think actually you've been on every third panel too.
Or been escorted out, you know, by a bodyguard or anything like that. You know,
I'm actually a lot more available. It's the cold, as meaning I'm having more downtime than usual. But yeah, mm-hmm. I'm usually up with the Filkers until 2 a.m. And for me, part of the cool things about a con is I can Filk until midnight. I can get into a gaming because I've gamed. You know, my high point was once when I realized I could talk to pretty much everybody was I was in a conversation for 45 minutes about Sailor Moon, and I've only seen one episode. Wow. But I have all that. I have the whole geek background. That's me. I mean.
So you go to cons. You game.
I go to cons. I don't game so much anymore because we moved out to the country and all the gamers are 15-year-old boys.
Yeah.
And I didn't
want
to game with 15-year-old boys when I was younger. So.
Yeah.
I kind of had to stop gaming. And I try to stay away from online gaming because the computer is where I work and I don't want to, sit down at the computer and not be
muddy.
Working.
Yeah.
So but why was sci-fi then a natural evolution for you? That's what you evolved naturally into? Or did you write everything and then sort of find your niche?
No, pretty much right from the beginning. Well, all right, in all fairness, I wrote a terrible in those 7 early books. I wrote a Western called I Didn't Know the Gun Was Loaded because, it's funny when you're 15. I wrote a science fiction novel called Light Years. I wrote a romantic historical called Richard the Lionhearted Was an Overmuscled Thug, or The Facts Behind Robin's Merry Men. Because clearly I had title problems way back in my teens as well.
Sounds like it's the entire book.
Yeah, pretty much. It was a very long title. What the hell was the question?
Whether or not sci-fi was a natural evolution or whether or not you evolved.
Well, science fiction has always been called the genre of the outsider.
Mm-hmm.
And growing up, my mom died when I was really young, so I didn't have that connection with the other kids in my class. I never had a mother. My dad buggered off when I was 7, which actually, horribly enough, has a fair number of connections with some people in the class. But I was raised by my grandmother. We were really poor. Mm-hmm. So I didn't have the connection. So I was already an outsider going in. I get to my teens. I discovered I was also interested in girls, which is kind of, although it was the 70s, so, things were a little more flexible.
Well, but then the 80s hit, so.
Well, from what I can remember, it was the 70s. So, there are whole chunks of it that are a little blurry. But so as an outsider, I was just finding my natural niche. This is my habitat, and I sort of slid into it, and I've been happy here ever since.
One of the big things about sci-fi is that, or at least I think, in my opinion, that science fiction asks difficult questions in extreme circumstances and then tries to answer it. Do you have any difficult questions which you constantly come back to in your work? Or do you feel that you're just telling a story?
I just tell stories. Mm-hmm. Stephen Bruce has this great thing where he says people write about what they think is cool.
Mm-hmm.
He thinks swords and capes are cool, so that's what he writes about. I think kick-ass women and witty repartee is cool, so that's what I write about.
Aha.
Uh-huh.
Well, it seems to be working out well for you.
Thank you.
Exactly.
That's a plan. It's definitely not causing me any problems, that's for sure.
So. What's next on the agenda?
I'm writing a 5th Valor book.
Awesome.
Which is the Space Marine books. So which started with, let's redo Zulu with Space Marines and giant lizards.
Very nice.
Excellent.
Which I even put in the singing.
And is there is there any online presence that people who are listening to this can go and find more information?
Well, I don't have a website, and I don't have a website deliberately because I find there's nothing more irritating than going to a website and realizing they haven't updated it for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
They started it with great, they've got graphics and all really cool things.
It's like big hopes abandoned.
Exactly. Yeah. And then nothing. So I use my live journal as my website.
Okay.
So I have a live journal at AndPuff, A-N-D-P-U-F-F, because Magic Dragon was already gone. And so was Tanya Huff and T. Huff. And
really? Couldn't get any of your fans to give it to you?
No, they were not my fans. There's actually 3 other Tanya Huffs on MySpace, and they're all having a better time than I am. So I...
But you do have the live journal.
But I do have the live journal. So I use the public...
Sorry, you broke Matt.
Yeah.
Cool.
It's just hold on. I'll press the reset button.
I use the public posts on my LiveJournal as essentially as my website because, you know, you can embed graphics and little videos and stuff. So that's very cool.
That's actually kind of the new way to go. I think static web websites are slowly fading away, and these kind of content.
Oh my God, I'm ahead of the curve.
You're ahead of the curve. You just need a Twitter account. And
I have a Twitter account.
Yep. Hey, there you go.
Done.
I have a Twitter account.
Perfect.
What is your Twitter account?
Yeah,
my Twitter account is just at Tanya Huff, capital T, capital H, all one word.
I beat him to the punch.
Yeah, this time. Ha. Take that.
Anything else?
Now, you do have the second season of Blood Ties is coming out on DVD later this year.
It's weird that you say second season because up in Canada, where we are currently, it was filmed as one 22-episode season. It's one regular network season.
Okay.
But because it was shown on cable in the States, it was broken into cable seasons, which was a 12 and a 9 or 12 and a 10. Yeah, it was a 12 and a 10. So because it was an American distributor, they distributed with the cable break. So you get the first season, second season. So for me, it's very hard to think of it as first season, second season. Because for me, it's one season. We got screwed over our second season.
Got it. There is a season coming out soon,
there's
whatever you call
22
it.
22 episodes. But the last half, yes, is coming out this week. And in fact, somebody mentioned to me yesterday that they had seen a copy available retail. So.
Oh, so you can
say it kind of jumped. But yeah,
but doesn't two seasons mean that you'll catch a better residual?
Please, like TV shows ever sell through. It's like television accounting, it's like nothing right, exactly. ever adds up past zero.
Yeah, that's true.
Although, in all fairness, the guys did, when they were fundraising, put a lot of their own money. The parachute company put a lot of their own money in.
Wow.
So, although we were number one in Kakistan for a while.
Hey.
I don't even know where Kakistan is.
It's not
Pakistan,
it's
Kakistan with a K.
I smell a con.
It was one of those, you know,
Khaki
splinter
con.
Groups when the Soviet Union broke up.
Exactly.
Somebody emailed me to say, you're number one in Kakistan. I'm like, who the hell is following the ratings in Kakistan?
Well,
possibly we're the only thing on television. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was going to say thank you for taking a break in the middle of this convention. You know you've been all over the place and doing talks and interviews, and I hope we didn't talk too much about vampires and what.
I'm the one who brought it up. You're cool.
No, I'm sure you've been talking about it. Day and night.
You write a vampire book, and you are going to be on vampire panels for the rest of your life.
don't doubt it. I do not doubt it. But thank you very much for being with us.
You're very welcome.
Enjoy
thanks for asking me.
Enjoy the rest of the
con. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Across the lake.
Casino.
That was a great talk.
I love her.
This was at the very end of the convention, and she was very kind after going through the whole con, being sick, and still having the energy to come and sit with us. And
she was fighting to hold on to her voice. God bless her.
Yeah.
You know? She had these the fisherman friends, you know, it's some sort
lozenge.
Yes.
Yeah, what I loved was
not fishermen who were friends of hers.
Tanya Huff is one of those writers that still, like, she hasn't been writerized yet. Like, as people go up to her at the convention, they're like, "I love your books." She blushes.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
She blushes and cringes at the compliments.
Yeah,
it's really quite adorable.
She's
so if you
sweet.
Ever see her, run up to her and compliment her profusely just to watch the shade
did
of
you
red
guys,
she turns.
Did you guys stick around after? They had like the little writers like meet and greet in the big hall. I think it was right after.
No.
Yeah, they had all the writers show up in that big room, and they put they moved the chairs into big circles, and each different writer would sit in one of the circles, and you could just go up and sit in the circles, and just everyone would just chit chat with the writer that you sat in the circle with, and
sort of like a knitting circle of writing.
I would be terrified if I was the writer going to that I would be the one writer sitting by myself.
Well, there was
there
was a couple of those, but people just moved around a lot and just kept, you know, I sat in a couple of them and just, you know, asked questions or just listened to it, and it was pretty interesting. That format was interesting. It was just a sit down and
that's a really neat idea.
These writers, yeah,
it's like my nightmare. Cool. Though, like, what if I wrote a book and no one came?
Well, you know, that's how art is.
Yep.
That's the claiming of Sleeping Beauty series.
Yeah, I was kind of thinking of that.
I know. I saw the expression in your face. Yeah.
I was like, should I say anything? Should I not say anything?
It's all good.
Well, you know, this is the first time we've ever done an episode in front of people, and I hope it worked out for the listeners out there. I thought it created an energy that we just haven't had before.
It was awesome.
And I would love to do this again. Maybe we can do it in L.A. here very
soon. I think we should do it in L.A. at our multi-million-dollar studio with a studio audience.
Yeah. Maybe for a Geeks on Birthday.
Sounds good.
Mayhap.
So we'll look into that.
So I think that wraps things up for yet another episode of Geeks On.
Yes. Yay! We're back in LA.
So if you want to get in touch with us, you can go to our website at www.geeksOn.com. You can email us at Aaron, Peter, Matt, or Don at geeksOn.com, yep, or all of us at geeks@geeksOn.com.
Yep. And you can actually write our contributors too now.
Yep. Smarty or John. Is it John or John Wick?
John Wick.
John Wick at geeksOn.com.
Actually, no, we did change it to John.
Okay, so it's just John, J-O-H-N, at geeksOn.com.
That's right.
Yep. And don't forget to visit our forums.
They're nice. They're nice most of the time.
It's resurging again.
Yes.
Yep, all right. So, and I will guess we'll see you back next time on Geeks On in a week, right?
Yep, one more week.
All right, bye, everybody.
Yep, rock it out.
Geek it out.
Next time on Geeks On, we'll be listening to an interview with Tyrell Hunt and
our contributors. Save this for blooper reel.
And our contributor, John Wick, will also be visiting.
I'm keeping this whole thing.
All right, cut.